Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
And the moment you've been waiting for months, David Lynch.
Thank you.
Okay, I have some questions prepared, but I thought, since you have just seen it and experienced it, if we have any sort of raw reaction or questions, if anybody just wants to jump in and say something or ask something.
First of all, you're a very creative man, a big fan, and I want to say that right off the bat. What just happened?
You just saw Lost Highway.
You've said that you've started with the phrase Lost Highway, that your spark for making this movie was just those two words. Could you talk about that?
Well, there was an event before I heard those two words, but I didn't know how that event related to Lost Highway. But I read Barry Gifford's book, Night People, and in it, two characters were talking about going down the Lost Highway, and just a feeling came over me based on those two words. And I said, Barry, I love these two words, Lost Highway. And he said, well, let's write something. So about a year or a year and a half later, we got together.
Now, you have worked together, of course. Wild at Heart was a screenplay that you wrote based on his novel. But this is the first time that you've actually written the screenplay together and written it from scratch. Could you talk about what was that like, that actual working process with Barry?
I know we were doing that, but looking back, it's a magical process because you can't tell where ideas come from, and it seems like it's just both of us focusing on something, and it was a couple of ideas that were fragments, and those fragments focus you. And it seems that they release a little lock on a door, and the door opens, and more fragments start coming in, drawn by the first fragments. It's strange because if any of you ever written anything, one day it's not there, and then a month later or 2 months later, it's there. And it's the two people tuning into the same place, I think.
Were you pretty much seeing the same movie all the way along? I mean, there's, of course, an aspect of this movie where it seems to be two very different things combining.
No, what happens is when you get fragments, the whole is not revealed. It's just the fragments. And then the fragments seem to want to arrange themselves. And a little bit further down the line, you begin to see what is forming. And it's as much a surprise to you as to, you know, anybody else.
Hmm. How much of it is trying to convey a mood versus telling a story?
Well, for me, ideas, even a fragment, conveys everything. In like a spark, you see images, you hear sounds, you feel a mood, and it comes complete, even if it's a fragment. The original idea comes with a lot of power, and you have to keep checking back and all the way through the process to see if you're, you know, being true to it.
There are sections of your movies where what you're mainly doing is creating an atmosphere, creating a mood between people. The whole first section, the kind of feeling between this couple. And the film takes a lot of time to let that happen. Also, in the beginning of Twin Peaks, the pilot, which we just showed, so much of that beginning is just the mood of the mother kind of dealing with the fact that her daughter's been killed. So how do you allow yourself to take the time or to let that evolve during a film?
Things either feel correct or they feel incorrect. Yeah. And every element that you're dealing with, you work with until it feels correct. And that's going back and checking with the original idea and how what is in front of you is striking you. Yeah. And it's a feeling.
Yeah. Now, in reading the screenplay, there are some scenes... What you've done with them when you're directing them, you've added so much more and emphasized so much more than what's on the written page. For example, when Baltasar Getty, when his character first sees Patricia Arquette in the car, and you play that, that magic moment, that's a, really just like a line of dialogue in the script, but it's such an overemphasized moment. You take that beyond. I mean, you go into slow motion, you know, crank up that song. When does this emphasis happen? Is that in your mind when it's being written? Or?
Yeah, it's in the script is like a blueprint, and so the house, you can see the house in the blueprint, but the house is much more. All those things are there, but the script sometimes can't be 1,000 pages, and many things are done in shorthand, but the original idea, again, is what you follow, and it is more than maybe what is written in the script at all the time. And then the process goes through the script, and you feel that the script is saying you know, what you want it to, but the process continues, and it continues, and it a film is never over until it's over. And the last things you're doing are sometimes the most critical, because then the thing locks, and it becomes itself, and it's the only time that the process is over.
How much mystery is there to you? So we had a question saying, what did we just see? What just happened? Do you know all the answers yourself? Do you know what happened on the lawn that night that we never hear about?
Yes. But so does everybody. There's things in life that happen that are supposedly, you know, unexplainable. There's strange feelings that we have. Many things are communicated to us without words. And inside, we have a mechanism, intuition, and sensing mechanisms. It kicks in and tries to make sense of the thing. And this thing is storing a knowledge that's very difficult to speak about. But you can sense much more sometimes than you can talk about.
Now, in the time before this film was made, there was a four-year period of projects that you were developing and then decided not to make. There was a film called Mulholland Drive, a comedy called Dream of the Bovine, apparently.
The Dream of the Bovine. I wrote this with my friend Bob Engels, and Bob and I may be the only, or maybe a few other people that appreciated this very, very bad, stupid comedy. Fate plays a huge part in our lives, and we may think something is correct, but many forces are telling us this is not the time for this particular thing. And you're sort of, you know, moved. It seems like forces outside of you are moving you. But when everything gets lined up, the lights start turning green, and you're suddenly the barriers have been removed, and you're rolling.
I'm an avid laser disc collector. Do you intend to get involved in any of these future projects, releasing your movies the way that they should be released?
Yeah, it's a tricky business. I would like to see everything done, you know, letterboxed and with great sound. I'm not too interested in doing the commentary, you know, like a lot of people do. But in some strange way, I kind of like pan and scan because you see things. It is a compromise, and a couple things, you know, you really say, you know, why am I doing it? But it's just an interesting thing that happens. Another compositions and things. It's not so bad, but I wish really that people could see the thing in a theater, and laser discs and videos didn't exist, because on the big screen, when the sound, everything is, you become inside the film, and that's the beauty of cinema, and it never happens on video, and it doesn't happen on laser disc either.
You pay more attention to sound than I think almost any other director working today. In the last few films, you have been credited as being the sound designer, which is rather unusual for director. And this has been an emphasis from the very, very beginning, even before Eraserhead, the short film The Grandmother that we showed here, which was sound designed by Alan Splett, and he also did the sound with you on Eraserhead. All through the years, sound has been a primary interest. Could you talk about
Well, cinema is sound and picture both working together, and all the elements are so extremely important. So I don't know how it had happened, but it's something that from the beginning I loved, and to see sound approach the abstraction of music and almost, you know, blend, obey some of the same rules as music, and how important it is to complete the picture. And again, it's just a feeling. Alan and I, Alan Splett and I, would always, you know, work side by side. And in those days, before digital and everything, we start with organic effects that we, you know, tape and then fiddle with it on now, but like prehistoric kind of, you know, equipment. But it's a whole world, and it's a beautiful world.
Sound editing is usually the last step in the process in post-production, but where does it? Does it start earlier for you?
I work with Angelo Badalamenti, writing things. Angelo writes a bunch of things for me up front that are mood things, and I listen to it in playback or found music that Angelo didn't write. And sound effects, sometimes the location sound man will get just raw things that we hear along the way, but it starts really the first day of post-production. We have a big meeting with everybody and go through shot by shot and talk, and they record that and then go back and start, you know, getting raw materials together. And then I listen to those, and we get down closer and closer. But a lot of things, as I said before, because of the speed digital, and a great, great engineer, John Ross, and he has fantastic people working for him at this place called Digital Sound and Picture in L.A. He really helps speed up the process because of his knowledge.
But do you play music for actors before scenes to get them into moods? The whole first section, again, with the couple before the murder in this film, there's a very particular mood.
We're always playing. Sometimes we play it in big speakers. It always comes through my headphones and maybe the DP's headphones. You know, music is a great way to instill some kind of strange understanding of the atmosphere in a scene. So, we play it for the actors when it's right.
And how much are you inspired by place? In talking about tailgating, it made me think that this film seems very much like a Los Angeles film. And you've said in the past that Philadelphia was the biggest influence in your life, just the experience of living there before you made Eraserhead. I mean, how much do you think place affects you? Can we see Lost Highway as sort of your reaction to Los Angeles?
No. Los Angeles is the city. But every time you show a city, you never can show the whole, or all the different feelings and different moods. Los Angeles has, and every city has, you go a few blocks and you turn into another place, and it's a different mood. So you try to find the places that bring out the mood and the look, and again, it goes back to checking with the original ideas. The picture is there, and if you're not able to build it, you try to find it. And then sometimes in finding those things, you get new ideas. So it is, again, a total, just on a feel, and you look until it is the place.
Yeah, you were speaking earlier about the process and development of your films, being working from blueprint. Do you take a similar approach to paintings?
Painting is, I think everybody would have a different answer about painting, but for me, it's just one idea that is strong enough to get me started. The final thing is not remotely like the original idea, and it's just an action and reaction with paint, and you get a dialogue going with this paint, and you have the feeling that you almost want to stay out of the way of it. It sort of wants to be a certain way, and it's talking to you, and you just keep on going, and it can almost be where time disappears. You're inside of some beautiful place. It's just you and the paint. Sometimes when you finish a painting, looking at it, you start hearing sounds, and or you could imagine sounds that would go, you know, beautifully with it. That's how I got into film. Seeing some part of the painting wanting to move and hearing maybe a little wind. So it just sound and motion started becoming a thing that led to animation, pretty primitive, crude animation. But they were supposed to be moving paintings.
When you were shooting, did you look around and realize there's still places in Los Angeles you've never seen and how incredible you thought about seeing them and how they worked in this film?
Yes and no. If you just went looking for the places that hadn't been used, they may be fine in and of themselves, but they may not be right for your film. And so it's a process of talking to the location scouts, and in talking, some pictures are forming in their mind, and they go out and take photos, and they bring the photos back, and then you look at them, and they are not at all, you know, what you wanted. But there might be some aspect of one, and that narrows it down some more, so they go back out again. Pretty soon you have some places that are pretty good possibilities, and then you have to go look. And in looking and seeing what you could do, what they will allow you to do to change them, finally you get the places. And it doesn't really matter if they've been used a thousand times. If you see that you can alter them or the mood is correct, you have to go with it. It's better if they're not a location that kicks in a scene from a great film, you know, of the past and confuses your picture. But normally you change them, and just the angles, people sometimes can't tell. The lighting and the scene, everything is so different.
When you go out with this monster equipment and you start on your project, working on the film, does it ever come back as like you're going to expect it?
And the first DP on Eraserhead said, dailies should never have any surprises. It should come back the way you expect it. And for me, you know, you can tell by looking in front of you what you're going to be getting way before a video or a playback. It's right there, and you've seen through the camera, and you can feel it and see it. But there is sometimes beautiful surprises in what the film and the developing and all of this can do. That's why it's very important to do some tests up front and see dailies every day, because sometimes strange accidents happen. Just at the end of a take, camera's panned away and somebody hits something and you see something and you say, Peter, what did I just see? How did that happen? And you analyze it and you see that you could use it for something else. Always there's accidents, strange little things happening, and that you have to pay attention to.
Is that how it worked with Bob, with the character Bob in Twin Peaks? He was a sound man?
No, he was a set dresser. That was a total accident. And it was an accident that, I mean, looking back, had to happen. These things are so beautiful when they happen, and if you can follow them, it led to a huge part of Twin Peaks, and it was just an accident.
The other night when you were interviewed by Charlie Rose, he showed a clip and said, what was in your head when you shot that scene? And you said, that scene was in my head. I mean, is that pretty much how you feel, that the film is what you had imagined?
It's exactly? Always different than what you imagine, because in the beginning, these ideas you see and you feel. But in the process of translating the ideas, many, many, many things come in. New ideas, these particular actors or actresses, that particular location, these sounds, this music, this kind of light. And so subtly things are changing. You're feeling it as you go. And then there's a point where... And Mary can tell you, where you finally see a cut of the entire film together. And that usually is one of the most horrible days in the process, because you see it doesn't work.
Do you see it with other people or just...
You see it alone at first, mm-hmm. But you know it doesn't work. So then you have another whole thing, and it's an action and reaction with what you actually have, and to find the ways through experimenting how the whole can work together. And if you're lucky, it snaps together.
And what do you learn on the first viewings with an audience? And one thing I'm thinking when I ask this, usually in your films, it seems like there's at least one scene that is, you know, is going to shock an audience. That is, I don't know if it's put there to shock them.
No, it's not. Like, you never want to manipulate. The thing has to grow from a place, maybe it's outside of a person. It has to come, and you have to be true to the ideas. And it's not ever done, at least for me, to make a theme come out or a message come out or a thing come out or a shock thing. It's the way the ideas are talking to you and how they form themselves together the way they want to be. There's a point where you think the film is working, but you've lost a lot of objectivity in the process, seeing it so many times. So if you sit with other people, they don't have to say anything. You can feel what is wrong just with their presence. And that's a bad feeling, but... it's very important to do it. You can learn many things from that first screening or second screening with people.
I want to ask about what role your meditation plays in your creative process, because you've talked about how you meditate every day. And it seems just this idea of sort of just being open or being in a different state must influence your creativity.
Well, I, you know, believe in this meditation. They say that the nervous system is the instrument of consciousness. And if you can expand your consciousness, you might be able to catch bigger ideas. You might be able to see more of the truth of situations, and understanding grows.
Do you use like other films as sort of like a creative springboard?
No, I think a film is digested. Ideas and processes. If you take from things that have gone through that process, you're further away from the source. And the ideas are the most important things. And they seem to be lying there in an ocean and available. And so if you could go in and get your own idea, now it may have similarities to many things that have gone before, but you feel it's yours, and you fall in love with it. And that's a very good feeling.
Okay, over here.
Hi. Jack Marantz was a staple of your own that you can say a couple words about.
I could talk for several hours about Jack Nance. Jack, I met in 1971, and he was the first person cast, the only one I saw for Eraserhead, for Henry, and the first of the cast to be cast. Again, fate is playing such a huge part because Jack, after working in film for maybe, 30 years now, I've never run across anybody more perfect than Jack for Henry for the roles that he's played. And there he was just given to me. We became great friends, and he's a very special person. He's, as I said before, he's totally unmotivated, and... So he didn't work that much, but when he did work, he always brought something very special. And he would sit at home in these little slippers and a robe and think. And he had the best stories and was a great storyteller and had real insight into the human condition. He was a great guy.
And how was the hairdo developed for Eraserhead?
Jack, there's again, fate, had a particular type of hair, and I wanted it to be short on the sides, long on top. And when we had a barber come over to the American Film Institute in this place where we were working down in the stables, and the barber cut it short on the side and left just what was there, but it wasn't standing up. And then as soon as Catherine Coulson, who later became the log lady but was his wife at the time, combed it, this stuff just stood up. And at first we were not sure that it was too much, but we went with it and very quickly became used to it. And Jack had that haircut for maybe 5 or 6 years.
You spent 5 years on Eraserhead. I just wonder if you could talk about how unique that experience remains to you.
Well, when you fall in love with ideas and in the process of making a film, you are able to live inside that world. It's very special. And the more you can sink into that world and feel it, the better it is for the film and your own enjoyment. You want to stay in the set longer than the hours that you shoot, just to feel it, and to be there. And in Eraserhead, maybe we had even a little too much time feeling it, because we kept running out of money. And it was a beautiful world. And when we were in it, we could imagine the outside of it, even though it wasn't in reality there. And that's a great feeling, to feel you're in a different world and understand it and feel it.
One question is whether or not you use storyboards. And I'm wondering what your feelings are about sexuality and cinema in general, specifically like the use of male genitalia. You know, there's a lot of women, but I wonder if you have any feelings or if that concerns you. Or
Well, let's just talk about storyboards first. Storyboards are—they tend to lock people in, and so it's fine to do some storyboards maybe for yourself. But if other people see them, then they think that's exactly what you're going to do. And some sequences that involve like cars and you know, the car chase with Mr. Eddie, those we talked about and maybe did drawings so that many people can understand what we're trying to do and get prepared. But in a normal scenes, never do any storyboards. And sex is all dependent on the characters. And the characters tell you how that sex will be. So since there's so many possibilities of characters, the sex could be, you know, many different ways. And I think the rule is to figure out why you're doing this sex scene and how then is it supposed to be to bring out these things. And and it tells you, and away you go. So sex could go from the low, dark hell, and it could go all the way to the spiritual. But it always comes down to two people, and they are a certain way, and so the sex, you know, follows.
Do you play a large part in the casting of your movies, and how did you get Robert Blake?
Yes, what you try to do, and it's a common sense thing, is get the right person for the right part. And again, that is a sort of a feeling, and you run different people's image through the film and see if they... if they are saying those things and how it feels, and some make it all the way through, and then you meet with those people, and it's just again a process to get the right person for that part, and then the process continues by getting them to tune in to the place where you're tuned into. And Robert Blake is a guy I've followed. I don't know if you saw, he was on Tom Snyder's show and talking about his life. He's got a million stories. Started acting when he was 3. But I think what really did it for me, I saw him on the Johnny Carson show one time, and I'm sure he has fears, but he's a one of a kind and not afraid to be himself. And he speaks his mind, and I got a respect for him after seeing him on the show. A seed was planted that I wanted to work with him. But again, finding the right person for the right part, finally it came along. And so we got together and talked about it, and he said he wanted to do it, but he said he didn't understand the script.
Richard Pryor was a very evocative piece of casting. How did that come about, and what was he like?
Talk show did it with Richard Pryor, too. I'd seen him his stand-up routines. I've seen him on JoJo Dancer. But... I saw him on a talk show where he was talking about a life he had been through and what he'd come out of, and I fell in love with the guy. He had so much wisdom and understanding, got such a good feeling came through from him. I said, I wish I could, you know, work with Richard. And when this part came up, he has MS and he's in a wheelchair, but he said he wanted to do it, and he came in. We had two scenes to shoot, and we finished those two scenes, and then we had some more time and put him in the garage. A portion of that is in the film, on the phone, and gave him a premise, and he ad-libbed for over 9 minutes, and it's incredible what he came up with.
Do you still find it difficult to get the financing for your films because they are so un-mainstream?
I've really been lucky, and again, it's just a fate thing. I know there are people out in the world who have great ideas and tremendous talent, and they can't seem to find the elements don't come together. They don't get a way to go. I've just been lucky. There's no rhyme or reason to it. I had delivered the Wall Street Journal during Eraserhead for a couple of years. It took me an hour to do the route. The first night it took me about 6 hours, and it was a very dangerous 1 hour because you're flat out, you're throwing papers from the car, and the Wall Street Journal was shipped. I'd pick them up at about 11:30 at night, and they had no name or address on them. I knew the route and would just give a paper to each place it was supposed to go. Then one night, a couple years later, they started putting people's names and addresses, and I had to sync up these papers with that particular person, and I refused to do that, and so the news seemed to be exactly the same for Tom as it did for Mary, and but they had to let me go.
At the end of the movie, I felt a little incomplete, and I wonder if that was an intention.
No. No. I would like you to feel complete, but many mysteries, as you know, are solved with no room to dream, and the mystery being solved is much less than you wanted it to be somewhere during the beginning of the unfolding of the mystery, and it's a tremendous letdown. I really feel that many things should be understood, but there still has to be some room to think and dream.
Is there something in you that eventually, whenever you're trying to either paint or work with music or, you know, work with film, that tries to resist the conclusion altogether?
No. The whole thing has to make sense to you, and it has to feel correct. And but again, it's based on these ideas that have been forming and arranging and finally showing you what it is. It's just focusing on those through the process. And if it makes a sense, no matter how abstract a sense, again, it goes back to an intuition rather than just pure intellect something that can be so easily translated into words by, you know, everyone. Those are beautiful things to me, abstractions. And life is filled with them, and cinema can do abstractions.
You've said that Frank Daniel at the AFI, who was one of your first film teachers, said that in order to make a feature film, you should take 70 index cards and have a scene for each index card, and then you have a feature film.
Right.
And it seems if you take that approach, that gives you sort of a freedom to not have to figure everything out. Do you?
Well, I think it's everyone's experience that no matter what, things come to us in fragments. And well, I got to say, Frank Daniel passed away about a year ago, I guess, and one of the greatest film teachers, I think, that existed, and beautiful person. So generous was Frank, and he believed in constructive criticism, and that's where you can actually criticize something, but at the same time, now the world is really into destructive criticism, and it's very bad for the person being destroyed, but it's bad for everyone. And so I wish that you all could have heard Frank Daniel speak and heard a bit of this wisdom that he had.
What was some of the reaction like during that whole process of making Eraserhead, where it was taking so long?
Well, Frank left in the middle of this. Many different regimes came in and at the American Film Institute, but Frank was always a big supporter of my work and everyone's work, and stayed in touch through the years and gave his support.
You seem to use fire as an image a lot. I was wondering what the significance was to you.
Fire, well, as we all know, it's pretty magical. And it's so strange to see things in life that seem to be dense and concrete and maintain their form, and then suddenly see fire, which is ethereal and moving and has a magic. But when you are working, sometimes the fire, you know, means this, and sometimes it means this, and again, it's just a feeling. So many things can be said with a picture and a sound that maybe a poet could translate it into words, but I can't do it.
I was just wondering what films in particular by other directors you admire, and for what reasons?
And for what reasons? I admire, you know, I won't be able to name all the people I really admire, but I love Fellini and Bergman, Hitchcock, Jacques Tati, Billy Wilder, Stanley Kubrick.
Now I have to embarrass you and make you tell the Stanley Kubrick story about...
Well, sometimes in life you get a thrill, and you get a thrill when you least expect it. I was in a place called Lee International Film Studios in Wembley, England, in pre-production for The Elephant Man. And George Lucas and a bunch of people of his team were over setting up, I think, the second Star Wars at Elstree Studios. And one day they were walking around and they met Stanley Kubrick. And they got to talking, and Stanley said, how would you fellas like to come up to my house tonight and see my favorite film? And they said, great. And they went up, and he showed them Eraserhead.
Can you expound a little bit more on your theory on coincidences and how you feel like they can guide your life?
Coincidences and how they can guide one's life. Well, it happens, I'm sure, to everyone. But in film, there's many, many things going on, and sometimes one thing will collide with another, and it wasn't meant to happen that way. But the things were all set up in motion, and you see the collision. And sometimes nothing happens, but sometimes that. Supposed accident leads to, you know, many beautiful things. So all I can say is they will occur, and the more elements in motion, the more chances of the occurrence, and that people should stay alert for those things. For the tiniest indication can somehow spiral out and be a great, seemingly new thing.
Could you say something about the project you have in the future that you're looking forward to doing, and is Ronnie Rocket one of them?
I don't know if Ronnie Rocket could be. Every time I've gotten close to making this film, Ronnie Rocket, for some reason it hasn't gone through, or I've backed away. But other than Ronnie Rocket, I don't have, I haven't caught the next idea, either through a book or from the ocean of ideas.
Which aspect of filmmaking as a creator do you enjoy the most?
From the very beginning through to the end, I love. And all the process is so beautiful and so important to sink inside of. It's when the film is finished, as much as I like talking to you all, this is the hardest part, to introduce it out into the world. You have no control over you know, how it's going to go.
What has surprised you about reactions to previous films? How do you feel about Lost Highway? I mean, it hasn't been out that long, but what can you say?
Not out till yeah, next week, but in France it came out.
Right.
And, you know, I think the secret is to work until you feel good and then to let it go, because, like I just said, you never can control how people will react. And you learn that sometimes it goes well and sometimes it goes very poorly. And you don't want to be ruined by either a positive or a negative. And success can blow you into a strange area where it's detrimental for thinking. And so it's better to concentrate on the next thing.
How was Blue Velvet for you? How did that feel? After Eraserhead, you made this kind of incredible jump to doing a big-budget film, Elephant Man, and then even bigger-budget film, Dune, and then this very personal project, Blue Velvet. Could you talk about, since we're going to see Blue Velvet later on, if you could just talk about that a bit?
I could say that Dino De Laurentiis cut my salary and cut the budget, and then gave me final cut, and so he was into cutting, and and Dune had been such a failure. We shot Blue Velvet, was in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Dino was on top of the world. They had many things going on there in the studios, and we were the poor kids on the block, and it was a beautiful sense of freedom, and there was nowhere to go but up, and and that's a great atmosphere to work inside of, and so I look back on it as a very good time.
While we're on the subject of Blue Velvet, what exactly is it Frank Booth is breathing?
Well, Dennis, you know, the other night I was on Charlie Rose, and Dennis had been on, and they showed a clip of this is true what Dennis said. I had written in the script of helium. And the reason I wrote in helium is because it alters the voice and makes it more baby-like, and Frank needed that particular feeling. But Dennis had and I think having, you know, heard it mentally is different than hearing it in reality. And Dennis had a problem with the helium, and he wanted to get there without that putting him there, and talked about many nitrous oxide and a combo of drugs. And Dennis is a guy you listen to very carefully when you talk about drugs. So, you know, he had a mental story about what was in those canisters. And there were four or five canisters strapped together.
Can you talk about your relationships with your different DPs?
Yeah, it's I've been lucky with great DPs. I think all of them, you develop a friendship, number one, a dialogue with, and you're talking about how this has to be. And I've never had problems. Again, everybody eventually comes to being tuned into a certain place. And you move all of us in the crew as one eventually. Freddie Francis, who shot The Elephant Man, the only problem I ever had with him is he always said, I wanted it so dark you can't see it. And so I had to work with Freddie a little bit for the darker scenes. But a great DP, Freddie Francis. All of them, Fred Elms and Ron Garcia, Peter Deming on Lost Highway, and I'm missing probably somebody, but and Herb Cardwell, the first one on Eraserhead.
Is it scheduling why you switch?
It's a lot of times people aren't available, but sometimes you meet somebody, like it happened this time with Peter Deming. I'd worked with him before, and you get I got with Peter a real joy in experimenting and pushing here or there. So I really like that a lot. And just a chemistry thing.
Okay, we're gonna have to stop in here, but please join us in the next gallery over for a book signing. And again, thanks to David Lynch.
Thank
for
you
being
very
with us.
Much.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.